Hello and welcome to our Food Principles module on plant-based diets. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to be here to be able to talk to you about another one of the quote-unquote food religions. And I like in particular to talk about this one because this is a version of this I've been following for the last 32 years. And the thing about this particular one compared to some of our other food principles modules is that there are so many variations on this. And that's a good thing, I think, because it gives us the opportunity to find what works for us and for our clients without being stuck in the dogma. Some of them are very dogmatic and they think their way is the best way, which is fine, but there's, you know, dozens who think their way is the best way. Our job is to find what's the best way for ourselves and for the person that we're working with. And the other thing is to also keep in mind with any of these diets is that finding the right diet for you or your client right now doesn't mean that that's going to be the best diet forever. Sometimes people are in a phase where they need a more of a cleansing diet. Sometimes people are in a phase where they need more of a rebuilding diet. Sometimes they're going to opt more on the way of more cooked foods, other times on the way of more raw foods. And the balance between the macronutrients and micronutrients shifts and changes based on seasons, based on weather, based on age, based on stress, and all that. So that's why we're pulling all these modules together to help you have everything that you need. So there's a big push in this modern time right now towards more animal-based eating. And there's always the argument, animal-based eating is better, plant-based eating is better. And the truth of the matter is, it depends on what works for you. And we're going to keep coming back to similar principles that then can be varied from everybody else. We clearly know that the diet religion called the standard American diet is a sad and very failed experiment. But we also know that there's a lot of people who adopt other diets that are very diverse from that and who fail on plant-based diets because they're not paying attention to their body's needs and to the macro and micronutrient needs that the body has at that particular time. So let's just jump right in and get started. And like every time else that I present to you, and when you present to your clients, and even in one-on-ones, is that making sure that they're aware that you're not giving them advice, not medical advice, you're giving them education about some options that they have for improving their own health based on your expertise and your clinical experience and all the studying that you've done. But if they're under the care of a doctor or they have any medically diagnosed conditions or they're on any medications, that they do need to check in with that practitioner in order to make sure that what you're educating them about and what choices they're going to make are consistent with what they actually really need. So what exactly is a plant-based diet? The original title for this was vegan and vegetarian diets. Someone came up with that title and I started putting the presentation together and I realized I don't use those words. I actually don't use those words to describe how I eat or how I want someone to eat. I more use a plant-based diet. I talk about a diet that's strong in plants. It's based on plants, the basis. It doesn't mean it's exclusively plants necessarily. And we'll see as we look at the types of diets that people call them plant-based diets and the different ways that people name them. But what do they consist of? They avoid animal products for the most part, and they eat a lot of vegetable products, fruits, grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, vegetables. And the difference between most of the diet plans out there and the difference between how you're going to work this out for your clients is the ratios, how much of one versus another group. And that can vary not just by person, season by season, year by year. It can even vary day by day. And when you can teach people to tune in to their needs and their desires on a day-by-day basis, minute-by-minute even basis, then they're going to come up with a diet plan that works for them. And I believe that a diet plan that's going to work for someone needs to have the flexibility to adapt. Not to adapt to allow in the chocolate cake at birthday parties and the M&Ms and the junk food that surrounds us, but to adapt to what is our particular need at a period of time. Maybe you need more protein after having surgery or having a broken bone or having some sort of injury. Maybe you need a lighter fare with mostly water, high water content foods after some sort of heavy trauma or that does not require broken bones, I mean emotional trauma, or something where it's summertime or you're needing a detox. So all of these things need to be taken into account. And why do people do plant-based diets? Some of them do it for purely ethical reasons, that they're animal lovers and they don't want to harm animals. Some do it for an environmental reason, and they know that there's a big carbon footprint related to growing animals for food in the amounts that people are using, and they don't want to contribute to that. Some people do it because of allergies. They take out certain food groups because they're allergic to it. And finally, people do it for health. They think that the plant-based diet is going to reduce their risk of heart disease, cancer, and more. All of these are valid reasons, and some people do them for all or many of these reasons. So when we look at the food, we want to look at the quality of the food, as well as the quantity of the food, as well as the ratios of the different food groups within a plant-based diet. The plant foods, if you look at this picture, it's full of color. It's full of bright oranges and reds and yellows and greens and purples. All these things make up a diet that's loaded with antioxidants, because those pigments are generally from antioxidant phytochemicals that have the pigments that also have antioxidant properties. And it's not a general tenet of being on a plant-based diet, but it's a general tenet of doing it for health, is that we want as much organic as possible, as much fresh as possible. I personally prefer a vegan diet to a vegetarian diet. In fact, I'd rather see personally, and this is just from my own studies, I'd rather see somebody getting off of dairy and having small amounts of meat than getting off of meat and having dairy. That's just my opinion. Well, I'll talk more about that as we talk about the different types of diets. So there's raw diets, there's vegetarian, we'll look at all the different types in a moment. So the types. There are people who call themselves pescatarians. They eat mostly plants and they eat a little bit of fish here and there. Some people call themselves lacto-ovo-vegetarians. Well, they eat vegetables and they eat meat and they eat eggs. Unfortunately, usually for lacto-ovo-vegetarians, they're eating a lot of cheese, a lot of milk, and a lot of eggs because they believe the protein myth and feel like they need that. There's ovo-vegetarians that just eat eggs and vegetables. There's lacto-vegetarians that just eat dairy products and vegetables. Then there's vegans who don't do any animal products. Some people who are really strict in terms of the definition of vegan don't do anything like honey either, because it's from a bee product and it's from a non-plant source. There's people who go raw vegan, and all of their food or most of their food is raw, uncooked, living, sprouted. Then there's people who are raw lacto-ovo-vegetarians, so they'll also eat raw dairy or raw eggs in the mix. There's some folks who eat low-fat vegetarian, low-fat vegan. And there's a lot of heart disease type books out there, and we'll look at some of those different diet plans that are extremely low-fat, and they work for some percentage of the population. And then there's the low-carb, and we'll look at all these diets and which ones and who popularized them as we go through this. So there's a picture of a lacto-ovo-vegetarian. That would be the more ideal way to do it, which is lots and lots of plant vegetables and fruits with a little bit of milk. Well, that quarter milk isn't a little bit, but a little bit of milk and a little bit of egg if you're going to do lacto-ovo. Unfortunately, that's not typically what the average lacto-ovo-vegetarian plate looks like. It's usually loaded with breads and soybeans and lots of grains and lots of beans with very little in the way of the vegetables and the fruits. So it's all about striking a balance, right? Then we have a pyramid I found that somebody put together on what a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet should look like. And not too dissimilar to our standard, you know, FDA-type food pyramid, and have grains as the basis. And I would say that you can actually make a super healthy lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet by taking out this bottom tier, or any kind of vegetarian diet, by taking out or making this bottom tier very little at the top, because the grains and the beans are not necessarily in the best interest for most people, for many people. I wouldn't say most. Fresh and dried fruit, vegetables, nuts and seeds, vegetable oils. Vegetable oils is too far down in this pyramid for my taste. Vegetable oils should be just a little teeny tiny bit of condiment way up top. But fortunately, they do have dairy products and eggs way up at the top, and then desserts way at the top. So I guess it does fit within that scheme. I would make these three top levels very, very small to optimize that diet. And optimize, put the vegetables at the bottom. But I'll make my own pyramid soon. So here's the vegan diet, right? So it's similar to that lacto-ovo, but it doesn't have the eggs or the milk. Lots of greens and fresh, beautiful produce. That's what a vegan diet can look like and can be very healthy. This particular one doesn't show a lot of nuts and seeds. It shows very little. And this diet doesn't show some avocados. So that would make it very low fat and very low calorie. But, you know, it's all a matter of finding the right balance for each person. Vegan diets don't have any animal products, no eggs, no dairy, and no honey or no bees pollen or any of those things as well. So we hear a lot about protein concerns, and we hear that from well-meaning people, but they oftentimes don't know what they're really asking about. So moms, when kids decide to go vegan or vegetarian, they say, but you got to get your protein. Where are you getting your protein? The truth of the matter is, everything, with the exception of fruit, has a substantial amount of protein. People don't realize that. Fruits range about, 1-2% protein, not much. But vegetables tend to be a very good source, as are grains and beans and legumes and things like that, and nuts and seeds. So this lists some of the sources. Avocado even has protein in it. Lentils have a lot of protein. Mushrooms have a lot of protein. Beans have a lot of protein. Broccoli has quite a bit of protein if you eat the quantities that I eat anyway, which I make huge pots of broccoli and then blend them down into make a soup, or I chop them up real fine and put them into a slaw, like a broccoli slaw. So when you eat a lot of them, you get a lot of protein from it. They're about 40-something percent protein. Hemp seeds, very high in protein. Green beans, right? They're partially legume, partially fresh. Those have decent amounts of protein. Tofu, very high protein, but people tend to over-rely on it because they think they need so much protein. And actually, a lot of people are suffering from protein excess, and the people who are protein deficient tend to be protein deficient because their stomach acid is out of whack and they're not digesting it. Quinoa, very high in protein. Leafy greens are super high in protein. I've done nutrition analyses by making a huge green smoothie with lots of greens and just measuring everything I put in it, and had some of my smoothies come out to be like 25 grams of protein per quart. That's a pretty good size amount of protein, given someone my size probably needs a total of 50 grams of protein a day, unless I'm healing, unless there's some other process going on that I want, if I'm doing a detox or something where I want higher amounts of amino acids. Chickpeas, nuts, buckwheat, all of these things, tempeh, soybeans, chia seeds, all of these things are a decent amount of proteins. And when you put someone on a diet that emphasizes variety and has a variety of these different foods at different meals, what you're going to see is it's really hard for them to become protein deficient unless, like I said, there's other health issues that are getting in the way. What are the advantages of plant-based diet? So I tried to do this in a non-biased way, because everybody that's written their books will say lower risk of heart disease, lower risk of cancers, and indeed those could be true, but those are statistical things. So I wanted to go back down to the basics of what's like the real raw grassroots of what advantages eating a plant-based diet has, as opposed to the risk factors. And we can talk about the risk factors in a bit. Well, lower exposure to toxins in general, because fats generally accumulate toxins, and the higher you go in the food chain, the more fat those animals have accumulated. So plants They eat the soil, right? They don't eat other plants. So they're basically getting as much toxin as is in the soil. And if you're in an environment where it's organically raised and properly fertilized, you're not getting a whole lot of it. But if an animal eats a plant, whatever toxic level is in that plant gets concentrated, and the animal's going to eat a lot of that plant, and the toxins get accumulated in their fat. And the higher up in the food chain, so if the animal that is being eaten is a herbivore, then it's going to have less accumulation of toxin than the animal who is a carnivore or an omnivore, and they have a lot of buildup of toxins. So lower exposure to toxins, again, in theory, usually more alkaline forming, but people can do a junk vegetarian or junk vegan diet or a lacto-ovo vegetarian diet where they're eating a lot of eggs and milk and processed foods, and they're going to be in an acidic forming diet. But if someone's eating the picture of the diet I showed earlier with lots and lots of just fruits and veggies and some of the more concentrated foods for calories and macronutrients, then it's going to be more alkaline forming, which in the long run helps with bones, it helps with the immune system, it helps in cancer production, it helps in gut health. Possibly higher in produce. I had to say this, not always. My diet's loaded with produce, pounds and pounds and pounds of it a day, and I know a lot of you do that too. But a lot of people who do more plant-based diets, they eat the more of the filler foods. They fill them up, but they're also the cheaper foods. It's much cheaper to get protein from lentils than it is from green leafy vegetables. But the downside is, you get not as much of the antioxidants and phytochemicals, so possibly higher in produce. Lower in heated processed fats, usually, right? Because an animal-based diet, you know, the milk is pasteurized, the homogenized, the cheese is same thing. The meat is cooked generally. People are not doing it raw. And they're a lot of times eating the processed meats that have lots of processed fats. And they're just much higher in that versus a vegan diet or a vegetarian. A plant-based diet is going to be much lower in those, although it's not all the time. There's a lot of people who are just eating grilled cheese sandwiches with soy cheese on them, right? That's a vegan diet, and a lot of people, that's how they eat. That's not going to be lower in heated processed fats. It's more environmentally friendly. We know that for sure. We know that in order to raise animals for food, the amount of land that's taken to do it right, to do it in an environment where it's not factory farmed and where they're out pastured and they're able to roam freely, that takes a lot of land. And the truth of the matter is, there's a bunch of documentaries, I'll talk about some of them later, but Michael Pollan, who wrote a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, was quoted to say that about 6 ounces total of animal food in a week is all our environment can sustain. That if everybody ate non-commercially grown meat, ate meat that was in the healthy style, which is what we would recommend, that it was grazed and not treated with hormones and antibiotics and pesticides, all organic feed, that it would just chop down all of our cities to be able to raise that amount to be able to feed the people in the way that they're accustomed. So in order to be able to eat healthier meat, people need to cut back down, and the planet can only support maybe 6 ounces a week total of animal food. And I haven't verified his stats on that, but that was what he said. Cruelty-free, right? In general, we're not killing animals to do it. We're not torturing animals, which is what's happening in factory farming. So these are all advantages of plant-based diets. And let's take a look at some of the plant-based books, and then we'll look at the downsides of plant-based diets and how you can overcome it. I get a lot of people in who have, you know, autoimmune disease or leaky gut or something, and they've been to an Ayurvedic practitioner or a functional medicine practitioner or some sort of alternative practitioner because they want a natural approach, and they say, you'll never get well unless you start eating meat. You have to be on a meat-based diet. And I think there's just a lot of miseducation. There are a lot of people who thrive. There are people who need to have some animal products, but I get a lot of people coming to me saying, look, I don't want to eat animals for ethical reasons and for health reasons, and I want you to help me. And I definitely can help them design that program. So let's look at some of the books. My very first introduction to plant-based diets was in Herbert Felton's Fasting Can Save Your Life. I was recommended to read this book back in the day when I was sick and I was full of allergies. I had gastritis. I had brain fog, headaches. I just wasn't myself. I was trying to get my health back, and I was reading all these health books. This book was recommended, and it talked about cleansing, and it talked about, you know, the need to support our detoxification systems, and it talked about food, like you do a fast to do the cleansing, but then the food you eat after the fast is plant-based food that's raw, almost 100% raw. And that was my first introduction. It was like so bizarre. I'd never heard of anything like this before. So Diet for a Small Planet was one that came out, Frances Moore LePay, and she came out in, oh, it's a while back, and she wrote this book, and it got very popular, and people quoted her all the time as saying, you don't get complete protein in plants, so you have to combine them. So you have to have beans with rice or nuts with vegetables or all these different things, that she, rules she created about how you combine things. And people were very meticulous about it, but they got fearful because it was like, oh my God, I had beans at breakfast and grains at lunch and vegetables at dinner, and I didn't combine them, and I'm not going to get enough protein, and my skeleton's going to fall apart, and I'm going to die. In reality, she wrote a retraction in her 20th anniversary edition to say that, indeed, we don't have to eat all those amino acid-containing foods together. We can eat them over the course of a day, and we had more of an amino acid pool. So the point is, she made it popular. It was not a vegan plan that she was talking about, but it was a lot of plants and included some dairy and some eggs. But she talked about that we can sustain life without having to eat animals. And then John Robbins came out with his book in like 1987 or so. It was just a couple of years after I got my health turned around, and I read his book, and he exposed not just the dietary, you know, advantages of doing a plant-based diet, but he talked a lot about the environmental concerns, and he really exposed the factory farming and the environmental impact, and it was a very popular book, and it got to be a bestseller, and he did some amazing work with that. And he didn't propose a particular diet style. He just proposed that we cut back on the factory farmed animals and that we eat more plants, and that getting rid of the factory animals completely was going to be one of the wisest decisions. Then along came the McDougall plan. And the McDougall plan was based on an extremely low-fat, grain-based approach. So kind of different than the Fasting Can Save Your Life, which had a lot, mostly raw foods. This had a lot of starches, potatoes, grains. And there was a distinction that we should go towards whole grains, but not a requirement. And there was a lot of gluten in it. And it was before the days of popularization of gluten-free. They got good results by working with people with heart disease. So here's the thing, though. They extrapolated out that what worked for people with heart disease would work for everyone. This is an extreme low-fat diet. Maybe 5 to 10% of calories are from fat. Very low. They exclude nuts and they exclude seeds. They exclude all oils, of course. And it's a great book and great ideas, but the point is that not everybody does well on that low fat and that high carb, and especially folks with insulin resistance tendencies and the genetic tendencies towards insulin resistance. So he got good results with heart disease patients, as did some of the others who followed suit with those sorts of diets, like Caldwell Esselstyn and others. I believe that they were working with a particular class of people with heart disease that were pretty sick, that had the ApoE4 issue. And ApoE4 people cannot tolerate saturated fats at all. They don't tolerate much in the way of fat. And so putting these people on a 5 to 10% fat diet worked well. But the problem with a very low-fat diet without any of the nuts or seeds is that it's really hard to get enough omega-3s. might be if somebody was perfectly healthy their whole life and they didn't need all that many, that they could extract those from the plant foods and the algae. But the truth of the matter is most people can't, and so they need a little bit of that. And there's something called essential fatty acids, right? Omega-3 and 6, alpha-linolenic and linoleic acid. So we need those in the diet. Those come from things like whole fresh nuts and seeds in various proportions. So to exclude nuts and seeds and avocado, I think, was going to a bit of an extreme. But that's just my opinion. They did wonders, and they did a program at one of the hospitals out in Santa Rosa area of California where they live, he and his wife. And this program was very successful at reversing heart disease in people who were supposed to be scheduled for bypass or had already been scheduled for bypass but turned things around. So, really good basic stuff. It's just a matter of extrapolating out that diet would be good for everybody. You can throw off hormone balance, you can throw off neurotransmitters. There's a lot of things you can do and get out of balance by too extreme a low-fat diet for the person. But some people may need it. Maybe their gallbladder's not working. Maybe they do have the APOE4/4. Then we had Dean Ornish, and he came out with similar to McDougall, although he allowed a little bit of low-fat yogurt, I think, or something on his, very, very little. So his was mostly plant-based. It was mostly plant. But the cool part about it is he combined yoga and meditation with the diet and had tremendous value in reversing heart disease. Similar programs where there's more grain and bean in there, not as much heavily reliant on vegetables. And here's the deal. It's going to be easier for the average person to follow if you're not telling them they need to be eating a pound to 2 to 3 of vegetables every day, which is, in my opinion, where many people, need to go in order to really help themselves, and that people are adding greens. But when you talk to people about their green smoothie, there's maybe a handful of greens and the rest is powders and potions and things like that versus pounds and pounds of them. You could cook greens. Some people don't tolerate raw as well. Maybe their enzymes are low. Maybe their gut mucosa is damaged. And for a while, we just, cook them. And some of them don't do well for a lot of people raw. I like broccoli. I can do broccoli raw if I've marinated it really well and squished it around with some salt or lemon juice and then dehydrated it to make it a little bit more like a steamed, or I just steam it. You do lose some of the nutrients, obviously, but it's a great way to go. So that was his reversing heart disease. Then Caldwell Esselstyn, cardiologist, came out with the one prevent and reverse heart disease. Extreme low-fat diet, but I think he got a lot of those APOE4/4 people who just did phenomenally on it. I don't know if they do long-term studies with people who stick with it, like how are their hormones, how do they go through menopause, what's their bone health like, and the other things that could be impacted by too low a fat diet. So I'm kind of, falling in that middle. I think with people with an APOE4/4, obviously they have to avoid, all animal products, probably most of the saturated fats from plants, even if it's organic whole coconut, just into a moderate amount, and then moderate their fat intake in order to get well, or they're very susceptible to heart disease. But this is a very extreme. When I read that program, I was like, holy cow, no nuts, no seeds, no oils, no avocados. I mean, I think you have a quarter of an avocado a week or something like that. So he does, if you want to check it out on his site, you can go look at the plan. You can see what his plan is and what his success rates have been. Joel Fuhrman wrote a book called Eat to Live, and it was a plant-rich diet. He didn't say vegan on it, right? He was trying to attract more people in to eating this way. But the truth of the matter is his diet is 90 to 95% plants. He does say you can add X amount, 3 ounces or less of animal protein, good, organically raised, et cetera, to the program. His does focus on a fair amount of nuts and seeds. He looks at those as good foods, whole food fats. And I think whole food fats are the way to go. We don't want people eating a lot of oil unless you're therapeutically giving them a particular type of oil to get their levels up, like maybe flax oil or MCT oil for particular therapeutic reasons. But in general, we should be eating whole foods, and fats are not the exception. The same way we don't want our people eating white rice, why would we want them to eat pure olive oil or pure anything oil? Because it's taken away from the full food. So I like to make salad dressings with whole food fats, avocados and coconut and soaked nuts and seeds. I don't like to use the oil vinegar. Not to say I never use oil, I just use a little bit of oil on things sometimes, not often, not every day, just to give it a little extra flavor. But I'm a big fan of not doing much in the way of oil. But it doesn't mean I think you should limit the fat. Some people need to limit the fat. Some people have problems with their gallbladder and their liver. Some people have the ApoE connection that they have to be careful about their fat. So again, it all comes back to there's good stuff in all of this, and we have to adjust it and balance it to the person. The China study did this study, and a lot of people have criticized the China study of not being good science, and people that criticize it are like Weston Price and proponents of very heavy animal protein diets, animal fat diets. And basically, this guy, Colin Campbell, he was not a vegan. He started out as a cattle rancher and went in and did this study, and based on the results he was finding, he became a vegan and stopped eating animals altogether. You can go either way on the science behind it, but I think that you can't do double-blind placebo-controlled studies. Everything that we do with diet is more population studies and comparative studies, and you look at rates of disease in people eating certain ways. So it's not 100% accurate, but you can certainly, when you combine studies and environmental and anthropological studies with the science of knowing how the certain foods affect the body on a biochemical basis, then we can make some good assumptions. So there's just a lot of food for thought, and there's a lot of this arguing back and forth, which really bugs me when we get people who are all out to have the same effect, which is healthy diets for themselves and health for their patients and clients, but they can't get over their ego and attitude of my way is the best way. Your way worked great for the group of people you studied or for yourself, not necessarily for everybody. So it's all good stuff, and I think everybody needs to find what works for them. They don't propose a particular diet. It's just that. Now, Rainbow Green Live Food Cuisine, Dr. Gabriel Cousins, he's a raw foodie. He eats nothing but raw foods. I think he eats 95 to 100% of his diet is raw foods. His food is about living foods, cultured foods, sprouted foods, soaked in germinated nuts and seeds. And his is a very low sugar diet, low glycemic. It's touted as a diet for diabetes and insulin resistance and candida overgrowth. And he's helped a lot of people with that. They include a lot of sprouts and a lot of salads and juices, vegetable juices, in their thing. And they have a phase one and a half, and two. And in phase one, you're actually trying to heal and trying to get rid of the candida or trying to get the blood sugar balanced. And there's no carbohydrate. There's no fruit in there. The only carbohydrate is from the vegetables themselves. And then in phase one and a half, you're allowed to add a little bit of blueberry and a few other things. And then in phase two, goes further. And we talk more about that diet specifically in the anti-candida section. So this is a diet that I've seen heated discussions between Dr. Cousins and Dr. Graham, who's the author of the 80-10-10 diet. And they're extreme opposite ends of a raw foods vegan diet. And both of them make good points. And they both work in certain populations. That's the thing. Why do they have to argue? Actually, Gabriel doesn't argue. It's Doug that argues. But it's like, why do you have to prove somebody else is wrong? You can be right and they can be right. What a novel concept. We can all be right. It just has to do with who we're right for. The hot dog diet, the the bagel diet, those things are extreme. Those are not healthy, balanced diet. But when it comes down to fresh, whole foods, we have to find the proportions that work best for each person. I personally do much better on this rainbow green style, which is more like my sweet spot style, than I do on an 80-10-10. I've actually tried that. And given my genetics and my early upbringing with regards to sugar imbalances, I cannot eat a diet that's mostly fruit. I am so off balance, and all I do is crave, like, oh, more, more, more. I want more mangoes. I want more pineapple. And then I'm like, oh, I can't think straight. So it doesn't work for me, but it works well for other people. For some, it's not mineral rich enough. There's not enough vegetables in there. There might be a way to modify it for a person. Like, yeah, they're eating a lot of fruit. They're eating a lot of greens and very little fat and getting most of their calories from the fruit. Yeah, as long as they're eating tons of greens. But you have to find about these diets, find out what they're doing, learn about them. Don't just tell them they can't do it. Learn about it, learn what's working for them and why they're attracted to it. Caldwell Esselstyn's son, who'd been influenced by Caldwell, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, was working he's actually in Austin, Texas, and he was his fireman, and he was at his fire station, and somebody, one of his people came in and was all discouraged. He just found out that he had a cholesterol levels in the 300s, and the doctor wanted to do bypass surgery on him, and the guy's like, I don't want to do this. He's a young guy in his 30s or whatever. And Rip said, well, how about we do this? How about the whole engine 2 is what they called it, the engine 2 group. How about if we all just support our buddy and we'll all go on this diet together? And they all went on a plant-based diet. He calls it Plant Strong Diet. And they did it, and in 28 days, it was a miraculous turnaround for the guy who had the elevated cholesterols. He got them down, and everybody in the diet was the area was losing weight, and everybody was feeling well. And people were saying, how'd you do it? We made recipes, and he started putting recipes together for people, and it turned into the Engine 2 diet. Now, the Engine 2 diet it's not 100% whole foods diet, in my opinion. It's got some gluten in it. It's got a lot of soy, and it doesn't really have any preponderance of white flour type stuff in there. But it's still not what I would call a completely balanced whole food diet. But, you know, when you take somebody from the far extreme of standard American diet, you can get them somewhere in the middle before they will move the other direction. So great stuff that he's doing there. Great stuff. Very low fat, I think. And then there's Neil Bernard, who runs the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. His diet, he's very dogmatic about vegan, very, very dogmatic about animal cruelty. So part of his stems not just from the health issues, but from an animal rights type of thing. So he wrote a book called Food for Life, and he created the new 4 food groups. What are they? Vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes. He has written a program for diabetes. His diabetes program is a fairly high glycemic program. It may work for a lot of people, but it's not going to work for everyone. They're going to go on that program and actually worsen their insulin resistance by eating that. So it's just, again, a matter of doing the due diligence and helping people to choose. And he wrote that other book, Get Healthy, Go Vegan. This next one is Dr. Michael Clapper, Vegan Nutrition Pure and Simple. I met him, I took a class, a weekend class from him way back when I was first out in practice. That was probably 1992. He had a weekend class. I didn't really learn much because I'd read his books and I was studying and I knew what I knew, but it was really great fun to be in a room with a bunch of people eating a plant-based diet, and he's very well educated as well. And again, this is more of a kind of traditional nuts and seeds and legumes and grains, and I've made some of his recipes for my family. And then we have the really irreverent one, Skinny Bitch. And these are two women who appealed to women in their vanity. Oh, hey, don't eat that stuff. It's going to make you fart. You know, oh, yeah, eat that, and it's going to go right to your hips. And it is a vegan, plant-based diet, and it's mostly whole foods. mostly whole foods. It's not as high on the fruits and vegetables as I would like to see. The produce, like most of these, they focus on the cheaper, heavier foods, and then the vegetables become a little side dish. I need to write my own book because I like to see 75% of the plate to be the vegetables. And that's where you get the most of the phytonutrients. But yeah, that got out there, and a lot of people got to be a bestseller, and people gravitated towards it because it wasn't this typical preachy, don't eat this, eat that. It was like, come on, you really want to be farting for the next 3 hours? You know, okay, if you do, then go ahead and eat that. But you really want to throw that on your hips? Go ahead and eat that. So very tongue-in-cheek, and it appealed to a lot of women. Forks Over Knives, that came out as a documentary, and then they created a food plan and a book. It's basically similar to the Caldwell Esselstyn, based on that, the very low fat for heart disease. But they talk about, well, let's just change what you put on your fork so you don't have to go under the knife. And when people are desperate, they will do quote unquote desperate measures. One of the more recent ones is from Michael Greger. Michael Greger runs NutritionFacts.org. He sends out these videos every day. I see his videos all the time. Sometimes I repost them on our Facebook group. And he's very scientifically oriented. He finds the studies. He shows you the studies. But he is also a little dogmatic. So you just have to take it with a grain of salt. That's all. But it's good stuff. He has really good evidence in this book and really good stuff about the studies and the populations and all this. And then there's the 80-10-10 with Dr. Doug Graham. And it's 80% carbohydrate, 10% protein, 10% fat. Within that 10% fat is there's no oil and there's a little bit of nuts and seeds, which isn't a lot of nuts and seeds if you're going to keep it to 10%. Could be too low in omega-3s, could be too low in minerals, because a lot of people do this in a way where they're mostly just eating fruit. They're not doing the greens. And he's totally against eating anything cooked. So he's against eating things that are heartier, like broccoli and cauliflower, because those should be cooked in order to eat. So he's in favor of the juicy stuff like celery and cucumbers and green leafy vegetables and that sort of stuff. But maybe he stresses it, but people that follow it end up mostly eating fruit. They end up being mostly fruitarian with a little bit of lettuce every day. And there's ways to do this. If it works well for somebody to actually do well on an 80-10-10 type of an approach, but you do it with more green leafies. And then this was Dr. Alan Goldhammer. He's one of the first alternative kind of functional doctors that I met after I did my cleanse. And it turned out he was in very close by, like an hour and a half to 2 hours away from where I lived, and went up to visit him and see his clinic. And he started a fasting retreat. Many of you heard it. It's called True North Health. And he wrote, this was his early book on, that was all vegetarian, all vegan actually. I don't think there were any dairy products in there. And simple guilt-free vegetarian recipes, the health-promoting cookbook. Very simple, very easy. And, you know, the whole idea is to provide a lot of nutrition and low caloric density and low toxicity. And then finally we've got Mark Hyman. And Mark Hyman wrote a really nice article, and he said, well, you know, I like to look at this stuff and vegan diets and paleo diets and what's better, and there's a lot of arguing back and forth. Well, what about a vegan diet? What about a diet that's mostly low glycemic, high produce, plant food with condiment-sized portions of animal protein? And it makes a lot of sense. So it's a really nice approach, because then people don't feel like they're deprived and they don't miss out on their animal products, and they can actually do really well on that. So he wrote the blog post, and of course people started books. So there's a couple of books on Amazon, and see what they look like. But there's just this one says vegan, but it says 100% vegan. So I would probably look at it as probably a low carb type vegan. There are a lot of documentaries that expose either the health benefits, like Forks Over Knives. There's the Cowspiracy, which is really good about showing the environmental. It was an environmentalist who heard that a plant-based diet was better for the environment and animal products did bad for the environment. And he did all the study. It's well worth seeing. Cowspiracy. I haven't seen Veducated. I haven't seen the Beyond the Myth. Some of these are just pure, like, really to get you up in arms about the abuse that's going on. So I haven't seen most of these, but Food Inc. is a big one. But basically, there's a lot of documentaries to educate people. Some of them are so extreme and dogmatic that it turns people away. And so the one with Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead was another one that was up there. So there's a lot of them out there. There's a lot of books out there. There's a lot of dogma. There's a lot of arguing back and forth. The reality is they all have pieces of the truth. And people can be extremely healthy on a completely plant-based diet. They can be extremely healthy on a high plant-based diet with a little bit of meat every so often or a little bit of deep ocean fish. The issue with a lot of that is you want to keep the toxicity down. And even if an animal has been raised and grazed and all this stuff, they're still going to have hormones in them because you're eating the flesh of an animal. So I choose not to do it at all. But you have to find that place where people can feel like they can follow it without feeling deprived and without feeling socially isolated, but also perceived well for their diet, for their own body. So the disadvantages of plant-based diets. Well, compliance is always hard. People say, well, I do plant-based at home, but when I go out, it's too hard. And I always say, you know, if you're going to eat animals, eat them at home when you can buy the best quality. The best quality organic, pasture, no pesticides, no antibiotics. Because when you go out, all bets are off. And you're getting a whole flood of toxins and other things in your system. So that's a good way to approach it too. So, but compliance is hard because when people are traveling, they say, oh, I just reached for the hamburger. I just got rid of the bun. But again, the quality of the meat is important. So travel's hard. Sometimes it's family. You have a family that doesn't want to support that way of eating, and maybe the person is that soul, that person that makes the meals, and now they're making two sets of meals. People use that as a downside. What I'll usually say is, why can't you make a meal that is great for you, that they eat, and then just add a piece of meat to it? So the vegetables, the whole foods, the nuts, the seeds, you can make lots of great meals that everybody could enjoy. And then if people want to eat their meat or they want to eat whatever extra they want to add, let them add it so it doesn't become a burden to make completely different sets of food. Social's big. You're out. You're at a party. You're going to restaurants with customers. There's all sorts of things like that that make it difficult. Getting easier and easier. I've been at this for 32 years now, and I find it a lot easier these days to eat out. I used to not leave home without just a cooler full of food, a stash, just in case, especially when my kids were little, because I didn't want to risk the kids. I could go without eating. I'd just skip a meal, but I didn't want to risk that for the kids. But now it's just so easy that you can find it in most places. Now, granted, I travel to very, let's just say, with it type of places. I'm here in Austin. I go to California, San Francisco. I go to Los Angeles. I go to San Diego. I sometimes go to Portland, Colorado. I mean, the places I go all have really good exposure and availability of healthy food and restaurants that support that. And I one time went to Las Vegas and was shocked at the kinds of food that was available, except in very specific spots. But it's like, whoa, people still do this. People still eat just iceberg lettuce with ranch dressing. Okay, very interesting. And a salad bar means potato salad and macaroni salad with mayonnaise on it. Yum. So yeah, there are still places like that where they're behind, but it's getting better and better. And then the cultural, right? There's certain dishes that people eat that they eat at certain holidays, they eat for religious reasons, and when they go plant-based, it becomes harder for them to do. And the truth is that anything that you want to make, most anything can be made to be similar in flavor, because what really makes the flavor is not the meat, it's the spices. Then there's perceived concern about protein. So let's talk briefly about the protein myth. There's this, how can you get enough protein? How can you get enough protein? I've done on numerous occasions where I've eaten, I even did nothing but produce for 3 days and tracked everything I ate, and I still came up with like 60 grams of protein. And then I've had days where I've thrown in, you know, nuts or seeds or stuff like that, and it goes higher than that. So I think it's misled to think about protein. We see protein deficiency in animal-based eaters and in plant-based eaters. So it's a lot of it has to do with how well the body can digest it, how well the pancreas can produce proteases, how well the stomach can produce the acid. So I think that that's a misled thing. I see, you know, you see people with huge muscles that are bodybuilding and doing races, and they clearly have enough protein or they wouldn't look the way they did, right? They would look scrawny in spite of exercising if they didn't have enough protein to make muscle. So I think that that's unfounded. It's just a matter of eating a big variety. If someone's just eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, or they're just eating junk food, vegetarian or vegan, then they're definitely going to have a problem with protein. And the same thing with nutrient insufficiencies. And I'll address each one of those on the next slide, but people are concerned that, you know, plant foods aren't as nutritious. And in fact, there's so many of the nutrients that are way more abundant in plant foods, and there are a few that are less in plant foods, and we should look at those. So vitamin A, preformed vitamin A is only found in animal foods. What's found in plant foods is beta carotene. Now, for the most part, we get so much beta carotene that we should easily be able to supply the vitamin A needs, but there are certain genetic markers that would make it harder for a person to do that conversion. It's called BCOM. And basically, that is a genetic marker for that people have problem with, and that enzyme, it codes for the enzyme that does the conversion, you know, the putting the two beta carotenes together to make vitamin A. And if people who have that in homozygous, which means two bad genes, one from each parent, they may have a very low conversion. Now, sometimes plant-based diets are so high in beta carotene because of all the juices and the greens and all, and the red bell peppers and all that, carrots, that they have so much beta carotene that it's easy to make enough. So if the conversion is not efficient, but you're eating huge amounts to what you get, but you can still have someone supplement an extra vitamin A, and you can test their vitamin A to see where it's at. Vitamin B12, that's one that's only found in the animals. Now, here's the thing, though. There's bacteria that can synthesize B12, and that's what it happens in animals. They synthesize it. Animals eat grass that hasn't been washed, so they're getting much more of the microorganisms that can create the B12, and that's why they create the B12. It gets into their tissues. When people eat it, they get the B12. So B12 deficiency is quite serious, and it's not across the board in all people on plant-based diets, and a lot of people who are on animal-based diets are B12 deficient as well because of the involvement of intrinsic factor. And if you don't remember the whole mechanism of digestion and absorption of B12, go back to the micronutrient module and look at the B12. And we do. There are some theories. Some people theorize that we used to have that bacteria living right around the ileum, you know, right around the ileocecal valve where the B12 is absorbed, and that they migrated into the large intestine, and that's why people don't get enough B12, and in the olden days we did. I don't know if that's true or false or whatever, but all I know is take B12, and most people need it anyway, because a lot, like 40% of the population, has SNPs in those B12 SNPs, the MTHFR, MTRR, MTR. So taking B12 is not a bad idea. And a lot of people don't get it because their stomachs are damaged and they don't make enough intrinsic factor. So, yeah, it's a concern. And it's definitely a concern. And people who have that concern say, well, maybe we shouldn't be vegan. Maybe we should eat some animal products. And you can. And you can get enough B12 by eating not washing your vegetables and eating the little bugs and crickets and things that end up, or eggs that end up on your stuff. Because the truth of the matter is, none of us is fully plant-based, because we are eating things that will fly into our mouths and that are on our foods. And I once bought sea vegetables, and it was Irish moss, the black Irish moss, and it had these little like I was starting to eat it, and I said, this is really crunchy. Why is this so crunchy? And then I looked, because I had soaked it, and it was mostly soft, but it was crunchy, and I looked at it, and there were these little, like, snail eggs all over my thing. So there goes the vegan diet, right? And so it's not a matter of religion or dogma. It's a matter of eating the way we need to. So if you need to eat something, an animal product that has the B12 in it, then you eat it, right? But you really don't have to eat it very often to get enough B12 because the liver will store it. Vitamin D. Well, first of all, most vitamin D is not supposed to come from food. It's supposed to come from the sun. The foods that do contain vitamin D naturally would be things like cod liver oil or cod liver, the liver of a cod, or the liver of any animal would contain some vitamin D and also vitamin A. The thing is that a lot of foods are fortified. So people say, oh, well, milk has vitamin D. No, milk doesn't have vitamin D. Milk is fortified with vitamin D. So what's the difference between drinking milk that's had a vitamin D capsule added to it or not drinking milk and eating the vitamin D capsule? Because the truth of the matter is most people don't eat liver. Most people don't take cod liver oil. And if they're getting vitamin D in their diet, they're getting it from the fortified milk. Right? And a lot of foods are fortified. So it's all a matter of getting it. And I see a lot of people with vitamin D receptor SNPs and problems with vitamin D conversion. And when the gut flora is not right, even though you're out in the sun, that all that conversion and activation happens in the kidneys and the liver and the gut. So they have to be all in the right state. Carnosine is a combination of two amino acids. And it's found in animal flesh. It's not found in plant foods. So we either need to be eating enough of the foods that contain a full spectrum of the amino acids so we could put it together. And my mind is drawing a blank. Alanine is one of them. And I don't remember what the other one is. And the body puts those together to form the carnosine. Carnosine is very helpful for tissue, for muscle mass, etc. But the truth is, too, that most animal eaters don't get enough of it either. So you can either eat a little bit of animal protein to get the carnosine and make sure your stomach is working properly and you have all your nutrients intact to be able to use it. Because, okay, here's the thing that most people don't realize. When you take certain foods in, so if carnosine is combined, it's a combination of two amino acids, there's a good chance that it gets broken down back into those two amino acids by our peptidases, and then it gets put back together, right? So there's not, it's like collagen. People eat all this collagen because they think it's great for their bones and their gut lining. Sure, but the body doesn't take the collagen and then use it right away. It has to break it down and then rebuild it in the proper places. So these are the four that people do need to be aware of, you need to be aware of, making sure that they have these things needs if they're strict plant food eaters and if they're eating them on a basis, like an irregular basis, just to make sure that those levels, so easy to test vitamin A, easy to test vitamin D. Vitamin B12 can be inferred from MCV and homocysteine and methylmalonic acid, which are functional tests for it. And then I'm not sure about a thing for carnosine, if there's a test for carnosine. So there you have it, as far as possible nutrient deficiencies. We talked a little bit about the protein myth, and I just think that this is a biggie. We get protein is what we make protein. We eat protein to break it down into amino acids to then be put back together. So when you sprout foods, when you germinate foods, you break the protein down into its constituent amino acids, depending on how long you've sprouted it for, and then the body has these easy-to-use amino acids. You've got great protein in sprouts, but it's in the form of amino acids, which is better than protein, whole protein. You've got protein in chlorella and spirulina. You've got protein in hemp seeds and chia seeds and walnuts and green leafy vegetables. So the protein abounds, but it goes back to you have to make sure that your clients are eating a well-balanced diet so that they get a plethora of the nutrients they need for protein. What kind of indications do we have for plant-based diets? When would you consider telling somebody to move towards a plant-based diet, if not a whole plant-based diet? Well, APOE44, big indication, so genetic testing, history of heart disease with elevated levels of LDLs and VLDLs, and C-reactive protein, so time bomb waiting to happen, and the stages of cancer where they're trying to rebuild and they need as much nutrients, which as little digestive needs as possible. Now, some people argue that people with cancer need animal-based diets, but most of the places that are doing really great work with healing are using plant-based diets or juicing for cancers. So those are the main things that I see, but people with gout, people with kidney issues, like they've got stressed kidneys or going into kidney failure, the too much protein from the animals with the nitrogenous waste can be very stressful on the kidneys. So here's the issue, right? Plant-based diets get a bad rap because there's a lot of people doing junk food plant-based diets. They're doing Cap'n Crunch or Cheerios or something for breakfast with soy milk on it. And then they're doing maybe some of them a grilled cheese sandwich or vegan pizza for lunch. They're not doing a lot of vegetables. They're doing mostly the grains and the analogs, right? You go into a vegetarian restaurant and it's all this substitute meat, which is wheat, gluten, and soy. So, and not a lot of vegetables, right? So if we're going to go with plant-based diets, it has to be high vegetable-based diets. The junk food diets are leaving people deficient, and it's leaving people with low protein intake and lots of vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So we want to stay away from that. What we really want is a whole foods plant-based diet. And if we took this whole foods plant-based diet and the person added, what did Michael Pollan say, 6 ounces a week of organically raised, very well taken care of animal protein, animal products to it, you'd have an amazing diet. Whether you call it vegan or paleo-vegan, or I like to call it plant-powered paleo, or whatever you want to call it, it is a diet that will sustain. Because if you look at the colors, if you look at this, this is awesome. And then if a person wants to do meat, they do it. And they decide the proportion of fruits and vegetables. They decide whether they're including the legumes and grains, or just some of them, or just sometimes. And they come up with the diet that works for them based on how it sits in their body. And then what do you eat, right? I'm going to come back to my bias here. Greens, fresh fruits and vegetables, the nutrient-dense foods need to be the predominance of your diet. Adding to that some green juices if possible, sea vegetables and the microalgae because they're so nutrient-dense. As much raw and living foods as tolerated. Some people tolerate a lot. Some people don't tolerate so much based on their gut. And fermented foods, sauerkraut, cultured vegetables, kefir, yogurt, natto, miso, all of these are fermented foods that are loaded with life. They're loaded with probiotics. They're loaded with enzymes that help us to digest food. Healthy fats, whole foods fats, avocado, coconut, which is great in caprylic acid, which is really good for dysbiosis and brain health. Nuts and seeds, non-gluten grains, legumes as tolerated. Some people get gassy from them. They need to try sprouting them. And if they're cooking them, sprout them and then cook them. Nutritive herbs and supplements, those would be as needed. We can do them in elixirs. We can add them to smoothies. We can add them to soups. We can use, you know, reishi mushroom pieces and make a great broth and then add lots of veggies and make a great soup from it. Add some mushrooms and you've got all the collagen-forming constituents that bone broth would have. And then making sure to take digestive enzymes with heavy meals, with meals eaten on the run, with those complex meals. And that's it for plant-based diets. I appreciate your attention, and we will see you on the next one.